What is happening, everybody, and how the hell might y'all be hanging in there? Just got back from a whirlwind trip in southern Utah, walking around on what felt like the surface of Mars, and I might have left a little bit of my brain there. In any case, today's guest is drummer Gunnar Olsen of Pusifer, even, depending on who you talk to. And it's part of the upcoming live stream event on April 17th, where they'll be playing The Money Shot in its entirety. Gunnar and I also get into how he got the gig, playing with the boss, touring with Muse, digging on drummer Chris Dave, as well as getting stoned and listening to the Talking Heads, which is a fantastic thing if you haven't done it previously. I highly recommend it. Plus much more. Crash Bang Boom Podcast can be found on iTunes Podcast, Spotify, Stitcher, Luminary, Google Play, Podbean, Amazon Music Podcast, and more. Feel free to check out any of the previous 200-plus episodes. Give me a like, a subscription, and or a positive review. Support is appreciated. Sponsor shout-out to the one and only NewOrleansRecordPress.com. If you're looking to release a vinyl, hit them up at NewOrleansRecordPress.com to check out the electroplating, mastering, design, packaging, vinyl coloring options. And they even have a real-time quote generator to keep tabs on it all. They also print 12 and 7-inch records in 150 and 180-gram variants, and they do small runs of 100 and larger runs up into the thousands. So hit them up, and that's NewOrleansRecordPress.com. Do please keep tabs on artist live streams, lessons, tutorials, and master classes from your favorite musicians, merch and or physical releases that are for sale, as well as websites like SaveOurStages.com looking to assist venues until we can open her up, as Andrew Schulz has said. All right, without further ado, here we go. Gunnar Olsen, hope y'all dig the convo. Crash, bang, boom.
Crowds go mad with joy.
Yeah! All right, I'm here with drummer Gunnar Olsen of the band Pusifer, who's got a live stream coming out on April 17th. Gunnar, what is going on, man? How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, man. Thanks for having me on the show.
I was in Greenpoint, Brooklyn for the last 7 years. I was in New York for 15 years total, so almost half of that time I was in three different locations in Greenpoint. Loved the area, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you too are in Greenpoint and or have been for some time, no?
Yes, correct. I grew up in Manhattan, like in the city proper.
Wow.
And I bounce around a little bit, like, you know, touring days and, you know, live in Astoria for a bit, live in Bushwick for a bit. And then when I met my wife, she lived in Greenpoint, where we now live together.
Gotcha.
And so we've been together about almost 12 years. So I've basically been in Greenpoint officially, unofficially, for about 12 years. And yeah, I love it. It's a part of the city I never really ended up in too much when I was younger. I mean, I definitely ended up in, I'm sure more of your listeners probably know Williamsburg, which is kind of right next to Greenpoint. I always equate it to, it's where the hipsters in Williamsburg go when they get to their 30s.
Yeah.
It's still pretty, and it's there's a lot of Polish families, and it's safe, and but there's still, you know, I live right next door to a deli still, and
yep.
So it's kind of, you know, it's a little off the beaten path. There's not a ton of foot traffic. People, you know, it really feels like a neighborhood, families, and all the people at the coffee shops and my laundry guy, we all know each other's names, and it's a weird little part of New York where I feel like growing up in Manhattan and living in Bushwick, like, it wasn't like that at all for me, at least. So
right.
I love it there. Yeah,
awesome. Yeah, one of the funny stories, it's about a year or so before leaving, and we left in late October, so in November we moved out here to Utah. So it's been quite a bizarre move, you know, open skies, yeah. Mountains, more cars, a large house, I have a drum room, all kinds of shit.
Oh, I'm so jealous. Yeah.
But my son was sick, my oldest one, and I had him by myself, and I had a gig later that night. And I had him, and I was just, I think I was like shirtless and in my socks, and like wearing cutoff pants. And I locked us outside of the house, and I walked outside and had to hand my son off to my little like Polish neighbor, who thankfully spoke English, because some of them don't. In fact, a lot of the people on the street did not speak English at all. And thankfully she did, or even if she couldn't, I could have said, hold my, you know, motion, hold my child. So I like literally handed him off and then had to scale up the balcony and then crawl through a window to get back in my apartment, because I was completely locked out with my son shirtless and in my fucking cutoffs looking like an asshole.
I've definitely come home from a tour and had a buddy, you know, like feed my cat, and then got home and he locked the handle you can't lock or something.
Right. And then, it's like, the bottom one. Yeah.
And then I'm like going, I'm same thing. I'm scaling down the back of the fire escape and, you know, walking by people's windows and sorry. and then also hoping my window is open enough that I can get in.
Exactly.
But then also being kind of terrified. Wait a minute. I just broke in. That meant anybody could have broken in while I was away for 3 weeks.
Wow. Crazy, man. Yeah. You mentioned that you've been up in Maine for a little while, which I guess. And where are you in Maine? Because I'm pretty familiar with it. I love that state. It's one of my favorites in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
I've gone many times up to Bahaba, as they say, up there, which is pretty north. And I love up there eating lobster and drinking white wine and driving through the parks. It's like God's country to me.
Yeah, it really is. My wife is from here. My wife's parents live up here. We're in Freeport, which is basically where L.L. Bean's headquarters are, where the company store is. It used to be open 24 hours a day. I don't know if it still is, but we're basically 20 minutes north of Portland.
Gotcha.
Yeah, we kind of came up here in July of 2020 just to get out of the city for a little bit of just to switch it up, and we've essentially never left. I've come back about once a month for a week or so at a time because I'm able to still do remote drum sessions, and I've done, you know, these now two live streams with Pussifer. So like I've done a few things, but when I haven't been doing that or coming home for like a week at a time, I've basically been up in Maine for most of this pandemic. And obviously there's so many terrible things and deaths and just people losing jobs and getting sick. But one of the kind of, you know, upsides of all this is getting to spend time with their family and spend time in this really beautiful area. You know, I grew up in New York City. So just the fact that I've kind of become this guy who lives out in the woods and has a, you know, I've never had my own car and I get to use their car. And so like, you know, there's a new thing for me is just driving around and listening to music.
Isn't it awesome?
It's great. And, you know, her parents are great and we have a little bit more space up here. So it's been kind of, it's been really the biggest bright spot of all of this is just kind of, you know, I've never had the opportunity to spend this much time up here. And, you know, I love it. It's great.
That's awesome. I mean, I love it that you're getting out there and mixing it up. That's definitely what coming out here has been for me. But how have you been able to keep up with your playing if you don't have a drum set out there? I mean, are you pretty much when you go back, that's when you're focusing more so on drum set specifically?
Pretty much. I brought a pad up here. My buddy makes the Reflex pads and I brought his pad up here and I hate to say it. I haven't touched it. You know, I honestly, it's been good for me. It was kind of nice to take a full break.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the longest I went without playing, the longest I've been up here and not been back to play the drums has been 8 weeks.
Wow.
And that was kind of crazy. When I came back after those 8 weeks, it was to prepare for 1 week in New York to go out and do this live stream I just filmed with Pussifer. So like I hadn't played for 8 weeks, had to come and like learn the record. We're playing their full record, Money Shot. I had to learn, you know, I'd been listening to it, but I had to like physically start playing it for a week before I went out, you know, to do 3 weeks of rehearsals with them. So I was feeling pretty rusty and I definitely don't really want to let that much time pass again. But you know, the interesting things about taking 8 weeks off from the drums, I'm still on Instagram watching drum videos. I make a lot of music on my computer. I make a lot of audio library music. So I was still working on music and listening to music. And it's interesting to see how you will literally play different than the last time you played.
Yeah.
For better or worse, you know, there's so many things, these like go-to almost like tics that we have as drummers. And it was interesting to see how many of those just weren't there, you know, and it was kind of freeing. The downside was that it felt like I hadn't played the drums in 8 weeks. And, you know, it took, I would say, about 2 weeks for my hands and just to feel that kind of inner confidence as a drummer, which I've had for as long as I can remember because I've always been playing or touring.
Mm-hmm.
And I did kind of feel like I remember like my first week out in LA starting rehearsals and thinking, oh, I fucked up. Like I suck. Like I'm going to get fired. You know, like I was kind of going down that rabbit hole of of doubt, and you know, it came back, and I feel pretty good. But once again, I've been back here now for 2 weeks and haven't played, so it's interesting. We're going back to New York kind of soon, so you know, we've talked about me bringing a drum set up here, but I really just didn't even want to like figure that out and just kind of take it as hopefully this will be kind of a 8 month period of our lives that's kind of its own chapter, and I'm okay if I'm not playing the drums all the time.
Right.
So yeah, it's been a challenge though, I will say.
Absolutely. It's funny, man. I mentioned earlier that I got this drum room set up. So it's down in the basement, one of two rooms. My wife works from home easily 4 days a week. So at least for an hour, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, she has to hear me playing drums in the house. And despite it being a big house, I mean, I don't know if 3,000 square feet kind of resonates with you as to how large that is. But for instance, my apartment, I know in Greenpoint, which was relatively big by New York apartment standards, was 900 square feet. So this is more than three times the size. And still, yeah. Because I just shut the door and it's like concrete, it's a basement, she still says it's loud as fuck, but I haven't had anyone over to the house to play the drums so I can have a sense of how loud right. they are in the house. So I'm just like, all right, if she could deal with it and while she's on conference yeah. calls and it sounds like there's cannons going off in the basement, then fuck it. I guess I'm just going to keep doing this.
Yeah.
Oh my God, man. Well, you mentioned Pucifer, obviously. And I'm pronouncing it correct, right? Pucifer?
I believe so. You know, I it's one of those things where I haven't had the official conversation.
yeah. Pucifer?
I think some people say Pucifer, some people emphasize the Lucifer side of it, some people emphasize the puss or pussy side of it. So.
Right.
I think it's a choose your own adventure. I think the band tends to say a version of it. But yeah.
Right on. Well, before we get to how you got the gig, the burning question yeah. in everyone's mind, or at least in mine, how long after getting the gig did you take to ask manager James Keenan when you were going to be able to meet Danny Carey? Come on, man. How long did that? Was it immediate?
you know, it's funny it hasn't come up yet, but, there's definitely been a few moments where, you know, his name comes up and you do have, I'll have those moments like, oh yeah, like I'm one person removed from like one of the world's most famous drummers. And,
totally.
It's a trip, you know, I mean, it's cool, but yeah, we haven't had that conversation quite yet.
Gotcha. Well, how did you get the gig? What was your ultimate connection, to them, and how'd you get it?
I think the simplest answer is Matt, their guitarist, who is essentially kind of, in a sense, the ringleader of that band. Maynard, with all of his projects, he finds people to collaborate with and that he really believes in and trusts. Mm-hmm. And that a big part of Pucifer existing to this day is Matt Mitchell. Mm-hmm. And Matt kind of, you know, he does everything from mixing the records to writing a majority of the music, musical direction, you know, even for like the live streams we've been doing, he puts together a lot of the concepts of it. Him and his girlfriend will put together, you know, like the videos. Like, he's very hands-on. And yeah, I got a DM on Instagram from Matt Mitchell and just, hey, I play with Pucifer, but you know, let me know if you want to talk about, and mind you, this was like, I think he reached out to me, I want to say April of 2020. Uh-huh. So, you know, my first thought was, okay, like I'll take a call with you. But I also had no idea really, you know, what could even happen because
yeah.
we were pretty much a month into all this. And I had a lot, I did a Zoom call with him and Karina, who sings in the band. And they were saying, you know, there's a bunch of festivals and stuff. They had a new record coming out. And they were hoping to, you know, kind of pin down a drummer for whenever live performances could happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an interesting, it was kind of an odd conversation. It was kind of like, hey, we have no idea when or if we'll ever get to perform again. But if we do, would you be interested? And then if so, would you send us some videos of you playing some songs?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think Matt had seen me play. I had done a tour with the band Mike Snow, and I'm pretty sure Matt said he saw me on that tour.
Oh, cool.
So I think he'd seen me live and then came across me on Instagram or something. And I sent Matt a couple of videos of me playing some songs of theirs, but honestly, it was a weird, like, I was excited to get the call, but it was also like, we have no idea if this is ever going to happen. Mm-hmm. And then cut to about a month later where they were still working on their latest record, Existential Reckoning. And they had a song and a half left. And he said, hey, do you want to give recording some drums on this song a shot? Which was great. So I ended up on the record a little bit.
Nice.
And then, last September, they decided they wanted to, you know, it looked like touring wasn't going to happen in the spring. And they wanted to, you know, the record was going to come out and they wanted to find a cool way to put it out. So the same day that the record came out, we put out a live stream of us playing in the middle of the desert in Arizona, this crazy complex called Arco Santi. Mm. And we played their whole new record, and which is great because it was the challenge of itself just to kind of, you know, it's one thing to a lot of these bands. And even what we're doing, again, a lot of bands are doing a thing now where they play a whole record on a live stream and it's something that the fans know. And this was an interesting task where the same day that the record was coming out that people could hear it for the first time, they were going to also see this live performance of it.
Wow.
So we had to kind of figure out, you know, when you play live, there's always going to be things that are a little different from the record. And I think that's what fans like about seeing a band live, you know, like that it's, oh, maybe they changed the intro or they changed this part in a knowing way. But we had to really figure out how do we do a live performance of something that no one's ever heard before, you know, because theoretically on the same day, you could listen to the new record and you could see the live performance of it. So,
wow.
And there's a lot of electronic elements on it. So they didn't want it to be a ton of tracks. So they kind of left it up to me to figure out how do I kind of do this hybrid of the cool electronic drums and then playing a lot of the drums that the drummer Sarah Jones played and some of the drums I recorded.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do.
I bet.
And one of the most kind of rewarding because it came out great. And their fan base loved it, and they embraced me, which is really exciting, you know, because they've had a drummer for a while. They've had a few drummers, but, you know, when you're kind of the new guy, it's nice to be received and not just be told, hey, where's this person, you know?
Right.
So that was exciting. And then the thing we have coming out, which is playing their record Money Shot, was a little more just like, this is a fan favorite record, and we can have a little more fun with it.
Nice. As far as expanding your kit with electronics to compensate for some of the electronic aspects that preceded you both on this upcoming thing with doing the Money Shot in its entirety, which you didn't play on, and with Existential Reckoning, what were some of the sort of voicing expansions, both acoustically and electronically, that you had to incorporate into your kit to execute that stuff?
When Matt and I talked about it, we really wanted to figure out a way to, you know, keep the vibe of things, but not, if a song is pretty much all electronic or maybe all electronic until the chorus, we didn't want to just go the route of playing pads for like a whole song.
Uh-huh.
We didn't want to totally rely on triggers either. I think one of the reasons he wanted to work with me or bring me into it is I've always really enjoyed experimenting with, you know, hybrid drumming, like layers of organic drums that can blend in interesting ways with, you know, electronic drums, like live drums, you know, kind of finding a marriage of the two. So for me, it was kind of listening to the recordings and trying to figure out what kind of textures will work. You know, there's always going to be a time where if there's a really signature sounding clap or kind of Lynn drum snare thing, it might be worth doing that on a pad in the first verse, but maybe in the second verse, you do it on a real snare, but you have a cut up cymbal on it, or, you know, like kind of finding, especially with the record we just did, there's a few songs that are all electronic, but one of the things I did in my quote unquote audition video, there's a song of theirs called Galileo, which is pretty much just a kick and a snare, you know, electronic sound.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, you know, I put some dampening on my floor tom and my snare drum, turned the snares off and put triggers on the drums. So you were still hearing the sound of the recorded drums, but then you were getting the attack of like my super dead dry drums, and it cool. gives a little more energy and life. And frankly, it looks cooler to see a drummer playing drums and not a round plastic pad. and that's no offense to anybody that does that. And I do that with them too.
Yeah.
I think we just didn't want to be like, oh, if this song's all electronic, you're playing an SPDS. Like no one gets a boner seeing a drummer playing an SPDS
right
in a stadium.
I know.
That was kind of half of the challenge. Was like, what's an interesting way to do this? Maybe if there's an electronic snare in this, we leave the sample of that in the song and I double it on like a stack and a real snare, and I can kind of play extra rhythms around it, and I'm not kind of a slave to playing this electronic part. You know, maybe mm-hmm. there's times where you treat the electronics as the drummer mm-hmm. and then you get to be almost like the percussionist playing around it, adding life and energy to it. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like, that was really half of the battle. It was just really finding what works for each song.
Right.
And, you know, and as I produce music, I make a lot of electronic music. That's half the fun for me, is really finding just interesting ways to do something that we all know. You know, like I grew up playing punk rock and, you know, listening to Beatles and all that stuff. And so we all know the drum set, you know, the drum set, but I really like kind of figuring out new ways to just have it feel different, new ways to express yourself, new ways to kind of work with the way music keeps, you know, progressing. And yeah,
totally. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, with the, when you said for the, some of the stuff that you worked on for Existential Reckoning, did you record that at your own studio setup? And if so, is that also in Greenpoint or in Brooklyn?
Yeah, the stuff I did for that, I did at a studio in Greenpoint on Norman and Russell. It's called Russell Street Recording. Mm-hmm. And for the last 5 years, I've had kind of like a, it's almost like a co-op. Like I've had like a few days a month there. I did the song Personal Prometheus there. Mm-hmm. And some of the song Bullet Train, I believe.
Okay. Yeah. Nice. Are those some of the drums that I've seen you playing on Instagram? Are those your kits in the studio, or are those just other studio kits? Because there's some great sounding kits.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Pretty much anything you see me play is mine. There's a green kit that is that studio's like older Slingerland kit, but mm-hmm. the kits I play the most, if you've seen me on Instagram, are probably, I have this great 60s gold sparkle Slingerland kit mm-hmm. that can kind of do everything. Yeah. And then, you know, I have an acrylic kit, a CNC kit. Yeah. So most of the drums you see me playing are usually mine, but I mean, also you, as you would know, in New York City, you know, with a lot of the studios, I don't have a car, so like yeah. it is easier to not bring, you know, I'll bring snare and cymbals, mm-hmm. but I'm not really carting a whole kit around if it's not my studio. But
right.
that being said, I haven't been going to a lot of other people's studios in the last year or so.
Gotcha. You mentioned cymbals and snares. I always like talking to people about snares in particular. What are some of your favorite snares from your collection?
A couple of those are pretty recent. I actually listened to your podcast with Jeremy from Q Drums the other day, because I've known Jeremy for years, and he ended up being the drum tech on these live streams. And he mentioned it on your show. Him and Matt go back way far. You know, they used to tech on Queens of the Stone Age and Nine Inch Nails, and so Katy Perry. Actually, I think Jeremy was also one of the reasons I kind of got a call from Matt. I think he reached out to a few people, and I think Jeremy vouched for me. But So until very recently, I was playing, you know, a different drum company. But I, you know, when it came time to do these live streams, you know, they said, oh, Jeremy's going to tech and he'll bring you drums. And he was like, what do you want to play? And I was like, well, bring me your drums, you know, like you're
awesome.
Like he's the man. He texts for like bands I respect highly, mm-hmm. and bring me the drums you think will sound the best. And I already had one of his snares. I have this Gentleman aluminum mm-hmm. 7-inch snare of his, which I got right before the pandemic, which ended up being, you know, right when the pandemic hit, I got a lot of remote drum work because everyone was freaking out. And I just kind of got more work remotely than I ever had before, because that's what we were all doing. Mm-hmm. And I would say that aluminum snare of his, the Q aluminum gentleman's, I was able to, I just left that up for probably 2 months. I mean, I was,
wow.
There was a couple things I could swap it out for, but you know, I will say, I feel like the snare sound that a lot of people are wanting these days isn't changing that much song for song.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really able to just like leave that snare up for, I mean, I want to say 2 months straight.
And, that's awesome.
You know, I know he also prides his drums to be as versatile as possible, so that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other snare I'm really into is the snare I played on the first of the live streams with Pussifer. It's this 6.5 brass snare that he brought. And before I showed up, him and Matt were like, yep, that's the snare. That's the one we're going to use. So I kind of showed up. There was a mahogany kit and this brass snare.
Mm.
And when we finished it, I was like, hey, man, like, that snare is great. Like, I joked with him. I said, I want you to make me another one just like it. And then whichever one sounds better, send me that one.
Yeah.
And I'll pay you whatever you want for it. And then a week after I was home, it just showed up in the mail, like the snare that I've been using. And I was like, motherfucker.
That's awesome.
So yeah, that was like the sweetest thing.
Right.
And now that's been the snare I've left up on my kit for the last few months. But you know, I have some older snares. I like, you know, I have like a great, like, Acrolite, or like it's like the Black Galaxy finish, like the Black Rolite.
Yeah, those are cool.
You know, it just does the thing. I have a great couple CNC snares, like they made me kind of like a Black Beauty years ago.
Awesome.
And that sounds great and everything. Honestly, being in New York, there's not a ton of space for gear.
Yeah.
So I think I have about 6 snare drums, but I only have like 3 kits. Mm-hmm. And I keep a few of them stashed at different studios, so
right.
I don't have to keep them in my house.
Totally.
And then I have like drums I'm kind of familiar with when I go to different studios.
Yeah.
But you know, until I started working with Zildjian in 2014, I think I had 6 cymbals.
Wow.
You know, I just had like the Ride I loved, a couple of crashes, 2 pairs of hi-hats.
Right.
And it wasn't until I got the endorsement deal and I went up there. I went up to Norwell and I treated myself. And I mean, at this point I joke that I've had pretty much every cymbal that they've ever made since.
Yeah.
And I kind of have gone the other direction where I just have way too many cymbals. It's like, I just have a closet full of cymbals, but I allow it because I lasted about 20 years with never more than 5 cymbals at a time.
Wow.
So I don't think you need to have all that stuff to make stuff work is my point, because I didn't have it.
Right.
Now I have it and it's great. I don't use them all, but I also, I do end up using enough of it that it's worth it, because like I said, I like to explore new sounds and I like to show up at my practice space and just use a cymbal I haven't used in 2 years and just
kind of
what does this bring out of me, just to like, even I'm just going to film a video that I'll put on Instagram. Like, what will this bring out of me?
Absolutely. Very cool, man. You mentioned working on electronic music and kind of I guess there's a little bit of a producer side of you as well.
For sure.
Having worked on electronic music myself, one of the things that I like to say is that it definitely changed my playing, I think for the better, both in composing that stuff and then kind of reverse engineering it and then physically playing something that seemed to make sense when I was just making it on a keyboard, you know, and then you realize, wow, this is actually kind of unintuitive and a little bizarre mechanically to play this.
Right.
But it's cool how that can then inform your own plan. So that's something that I've definitely been digging. But one of the questions that I like to ask guys that work on the production side as well is just like, what are some of the drummers that you dig that have that sense? Because immediately guys like, and I spoke about it recently, was like JoJo Mayer and Matt Chamberlain are like guys.
Oh, totally.
When I hear them, I'm like, such an ear for their sound, both live and in studio. And it's like, those guys are just absolute inspirations to me in that regard.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I mean, those are two perfect examples. Matt specifically, Matt was one of those drummers where I feel like the year I kind of found out about him, he just kept ending up, like, I kept listening to a record and loving it and then being like, who's the drummer in this? And it kept being him,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And especially the stuff he did with Fiona Apple.
Of course.
The stuff where, like, the drums just, they sound, you can't tell if it's a loop. If it's a loop that's him that he cut up, is he playing it? Is his drums, or his drums affected?
Yeah.
And that was a huge inspiration to me. I credit my wife a lot with getting me into a lot of the electronic music that she was into.
Yeah.
And, that definitely opened up a door to, that. But I feel like he kind of helped get me into that. And JoJo too, like those early, what was it, like early 2000s, there's like this one video of him playing in like Times Square, like playing live drum and bass beats.
Right.
I had just gone kind of into Square Pusher and some of these like actual drum and bass artists.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't, I couldn't comprehend that like a drummer could sound like that.
Absolutely.
Another one I would list would be Chris Dave.
Totally.
I had a few friends that were kind of friends with a bunch of people from Houston. And I would say early, maybe 2003 or so, we had a great, I was in a band called The Exit in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
Our guitarist met this girl named Lisa from Houston. I remember her taking us to the 55 bar
mm-hmm.
in New York City and to see Robert Glasper.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know him. And Chris was playing with him and I hadn't heard of any of these guys. And they played this version of jazz and it was, it's kind of the building blocks for this newer, I feel like there's a way that drums that a lot of people are playing kind of like the half swung,
uh-huh.
half straight, like Dilla, Jay Dilla inspired,
mm-hmm.
but I was watching him do this in real time, and I was in my early 20s and I just graduated music school and I thought I was into like cool music and I'm watching him play the drums and it's like he was doing that very exaggerated like push pull thing.
Totally.
And my brain just, I couldn't understand what I was seeing because it didn't seem like it should look, sound good or feel good. And it was just amazing. And it was one of those experiences where you see something and you kind of feel like it's your own little secret and no one else knows about it.
Yeah.
Cause a 55 bar holds maybe like 20, 50, I don't know, 50 people at most.
Mm-hmm.
And, cut to like 10 years later and he's on the cover of all these magazines and has inspired all these other drummers.
Right.
But he was one of those people that's just like, he sounded like samples.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, those things have definitely stuck with me. A lot of the stuff I've been doing more recently to kind of bridge that gap is in the last few years, I've been running like my drums through like pedals.
Mm-hmm.
For years, I would record myself and try to chop it up and make cool stuff out of it. And then I'd say starting around 2017, 2018, I started to like find ways to run my drums through like pedals and just any like loop pedals,
yep.
distortion pedals, just anything to kind of get my drums to sound immediately like how I wanted to process them.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that kind of started to make me think differently when playing too.
Right.
But I mean, a lot of us are recording ourselves more than ever because of the pandemic. And I think just like going back a step, even if you're into electronic music or not, the more you record yourself, the more you kind of expose yourself to yourself and can kind of hear like what's working and what's not.
Mm-hmm.
As a drummer, there's a lot of things that are fun to play, but aren't necessarily fun to listen to.
Right.
And, I think playing with electronic music or playing, to it, playing with it, making it, you can really quickly figure out what's working and what's not. And it tends to be less is more, sticking to a theme and really just not like overthinking it.
Right.
So much electronic music derives from samples of actual drummers.
Totally.
So, it's all in us.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing JoJo Mayer play a drum and bass beat is so fascinating because he's playing a version of electronic music that sampled a drummer from the 60s and sped it up two times as fast.
Right.
But he's making it sound like the electronic version. And, right. You know, you take it from there. And yeah, it's great.
I hear you, man. You had mentioned going to music school and obviously growing up in Manhattan. How'd you gravitate towards the drums in the first place? And was going to music school, was that the first time that you kind of studied the kit specifically, or did you have teachers along the way?
My dad's a musician. He retired about a year ago. He's a Broadway musician.
Oh, wow.
So it was kind of just the idea that you could be a professional musician was always there. Didn't necessarily mean I thought I wanted to do that, but there was never the moment of my parents, my mom's an artist. There mm-hmm. was never that moment of what are you really going to do? You know? Right. So I think because of that, I had a little time to kind of feel it out. And I was never too interested in music or playing music. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just because we lived in Manhattan and you couldn't really do it that easily.
Right.
My uncle's a drummer. He lives out in South Dakota. And I thought the drums were cool. For some reason, one day I asked my dad if I could have a drum pad.
Yeah.
I got that drum pad probably 2 weeks before Nirvana's Nevermind came out. And it was just, it connected the dots. You know, he said, well, I think I wanted to drum, or maybe I might've even said, can I play the drums? And he said, well, we'll start you with a drum pad. Mm-hmm. And if you do good, then maybe we'll buy you a snare. Maybe we'll buy you a cymbal. Mm-hmm. But you got to take lessons.
Right.
And, it was like right when Nevermind came out. So I had that kind of like, well, I have something I want to play along to. So I'm mm-hmm. asking my teacher to show me how to play these beats. And he's like, well, this is cool, but the reason he plays like this is because of this guy, John Bonham. So then I'm going to teach you a John Bonham beat before I teach you a Nirvana beat, you know, like stuff like that. And then a year after that was when high school was rolling around. And so it was kind of like, well, I'm playing the drums. Okay. I need to go to high school so I can go to this music and arts high school, LaGuardia. Mm-hmm. And so my whole high school experience was playing in the jazz band and the orchestra, you know, before I knew it, I was just kind of already doing almost like a college level music course, but just in high school.
Wow.
So, you know, when college came around, it was kind of the obvious answer. Like, well, I'll just kind of keep going.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it just kind of happened. You know, it was like, my dad just wanted me to go. He wanted me to go to college. I was getting pretty good at the drums. So it just kind of made sense. I went to the place, I got the most scholarship money, so I didn't have to owe any money when I was done.
Right.
Yeah, I went to school at SUNY Purchase. I technically studied jazz, but you know, I still to this day played like four jazz gigs in my life, but I worked with these amazing teachers. I played in the big band, which was really fun because it's pretty much like the loudest, most rock band version of jazz you can play.
Totally.
You know, playing with a whole like band that size kind of was amazing.
Right.
But I always wanted to just be in a band. So, you know, the second I graduated, I was in a van, started touring, and never really like, just honestly never had time to figure out what am I going to do. It just kind of kept being in a van, sleeping on people's floors, and then had a record deal. And then that band broke up, but the guy at my label liked my drumming, so he started calling me for sessions. And it cut to like, then there's social media, and then my buddy works for Springsteen, so he gets me on a Springsteen record. And just like,
right.
Matt Mitchell finds me. Like, it's just, it's one of those things where like, sometimes I'll stay up late at night and I'll think about, man, if I hadn't just done this one thing, all these other things might not have just kind of happened.
Totally.
And, but you know, that being said, I have to be good enough so when the opportunity presents itself, I can kind of hang
mm-hmm.
and not be an asshole. And I mean, yeah. that's half of it.
Absolutely.
People want to be around someone that's like nice to be around and like maybe cracks a good joke here and there
yeah.
and can also play the drums pretty good.
Right. You mentioned Springsteen for a second. I think I saw some pictures of that. Speaking of playing with a massive band, what was the story with that and how many people were in on that session? Because it looked like a lot of people involved in the session.
Yeah, that's kind of a two-part answer. So basically, when I graduated college, kind of the band I was in at the time was called The Exit. And I did that for maybe 2001 to 2005. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of my first real band where we were going on tour. We were making enough money that we were living in a shithole in Bushwick, but you know, yeah. we didn't have jobs.
Right.
And we got signed to a big indie label, and they gave us probably one of the last big advances before the record industry kind of crumbled.
Wow.
And yeah, here I am, like I can live for 2 years off of this record advance, and nothing really came about from it, but you know, we got to tour with like Muse and like 311 and like cool, like it was fun. It was like a great time. And we ended up doing our second record at Avatar, which is now called the Power Station, mm-hmm. or was called Power Station. And then blah, blah, blah. It's currently the Power Station in New York. Mm-hmm. And my now buddy Ross Peterson worked at Avatar. We just became good buddies, and he worked on a lot of well-known records at Avatar and then started to be called for things just as an engineer. Yeah. And yeah, he had this gig engineering for Springsteen. Wow. And we all knew about it, and he always had to be kind of tight-lipped about it because it's a pretty, you know, NDA world. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Bruce tends to make an E Street record and then every couple of years make his own record. And it was one of his solo records, which means he'll kind of work with whoever.
Yeah.
And I think they honestly had some other drummers in mind for some stuff, but you know, the producer wanted to work on some songs. They were writing a lot of the songs from the ground floor up, where Bruce was on tour, but would come home, has a studio on his property, mm-hmm. would come home and write a song on acoustic guitar and then leave. And then Ron and Yellow, the producer, would build up a song around it. And wow. then Bruce would come back and work on it some more. And they were at the point where they wanted to add some drums to something. And Ross, my buddy, vouched for me and said, hey, I got a guy. He lives over in Brooklyn. You know, it's like an hour and a half away. Even if he doesn't end up on the record, you can have him come in and demo some drum ideas for whoever, insert any huge famous drummer you want to bring in.
Yeah.
And yeah, he got me in the studio, and I've told the story a bunch, but basically I showed up on a day that Bruce wasn't supposed to be there.
Ah.
And then Bruce showed up.
Oh, okay.
And so we were in the process of working on some stuff, and he kind of showed up out of nowhere to hear where a few songs were at.
Mm-hmm.
And because they were doing everything without him, it was the first time he was hearing things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm there. I've played on a couple of songs. I played on one song.
Yeah.
And which we hadn't even listened to, and he kind of barges in out of nowhere, and he wants to hear the status of Sleepy Joe's Cafe. And then we listen to Sleepy Joe's Cafe, and there's a few famous drummers playing on it, and they sound great, but he still has some thoughts. And there's literally a drummer sitting in the room, me, who he just met, and I was in a position where, hey, can you give me some options on this song? And then mm-hmm. before I knew it, the day was over. I played on four songs.
Wow.
You know, I got called back for three more sessions. And so that record is his record, Western Stars. I think I'm on, cool. I'm on six out of 11 songs. And Matt Chamberlain is on the other song.
Oh, amazing.
It's crazy. And basically that record was on the shelf for 5 years.
Wow.
So we did it. I couldn't tell anybody about it for 5 years. Had no idea if it would come out.
Oh, wow.
And then 5 years later, they decide to put it out. He decides, well, I'm probably not going to go on tour with this, so I'm going to shoot a movie of me playing this live.
Whoa.
So the stuff you've seen with like a 30-piece orchestra was us filming it. It was in the theaters for, I don't know, a couple months.
Yeah.
But yeah, we recorded the whole record, you know, piece by piece, and then we played it live because he was kind of going for like a Glen Campbell
mm-hmm.
wall of sound, like strings, horns, like just kind of like big country music before it was twangy, like just kind of Americana,
right.
Western sounding stuff.
Sure.
And so yeah, we did it with this 30-piece orchestra and a 6-piece like rock band, like great players like Kaveh Rastegar, who plays in Kneebody and plays with John Legend, and like just like this, like the tier of people I was playing with, just like these killers, you know. And the band sounded so great, and then fucking Bruce Springsteen's there, you know, counting off every song, 1, 2, 3, you know, like just like pinch me stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm on a, I'm in a movie and I'm on a record with fucking the boss. So it's like, so thank you to my friend Ross for calling me out to Jersey that one day in March of 2014. Yeah.
Wow. Man, I'd say the moral of the story is both put yourself out there because you never know the sequence of events that could lead you down some place that you might not otherwise have found yourself. And as you said earlier, and it is a big component, don't be a dick. Be someone that someone wants to be around. That they're, because again, there are lots of guys and girls and everyone in between that have great chops and could do a lot of stuff. But you could be so easily replaced with this stuff if you're a pain in the ass, and no one at a certain level is going to put up with that shit.
Yeah. And, you know, no, I didn't get called in that into that session because somebody saw me playing paradiddles at 250 BPM. You know, it's just somebody vouches for you and you just don't fuck up.
Right.
I mean, playing with Bruce and Maynard are pretty different, but they're similar in the sense where, like, they're these people that you grew up seeing on MTV. For me, like, MTV was everything, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like from the... We got MTV probably like 85, probably from like 85 to 1999. I just watch MTV all the time. You know, that's how I found out about Nirvana, Springsteen, fucking Tool, like all these people. You know, you have these moments where you're playing with people you've watched, but you also realize, you know, the thing that those guys have in common, Springsteen and Maynard, that obviously everybody knows who they are, but they have the same ethos and vibe of like the guys I was always in bands with sleeping on floors. Like they just want to, they want to make something that they're proud of. They want to work hard and just keep your head down. Don't be a dick and try hard. And you feel more comfortable around them than you think you would, because they got to a very far place notoriety wise, but they're just like, they're doing what we all want to do. You know?
Right.
Totally. At least what I want to do. What I want to do.
Totally, man. Yeah. Well, you mentioned sort of the strange year with going up to Maine and everything that the portion, or at least the majority of 2020 was for you. And you mentioned riding around in cars, listening to music. As I said, I've been loving doing that shit since I'm out here.
Yeah.
I roll the windows down, crank at the truck. Stereo is sounding killer right now. Were there any particular records, one or two, three, whatever, that you were especially kind of obsessing over and driving around and listening to it in the car?
Yeah, the two that stick out. So when Eddie Van Halen passed away, obviously I grew up on Van Halen, but I kind of like, I just really went down the rabbit hole again. And so I kind of like, I started at the beginning again and I listened to, you know, like I just kind of went in order pretty much up until the Sammy stuff, you know, I gave it a shot.
Yeah.
There was one car ride, you know, cause I was going, like I mentioned, I was going between Freeport up here in Maine to Brooklyn a lot.
Right.
And there was one drive. My goal was to listen to every Van Halen record, like everyone. Yeah. And I probably got like two or three deep into the Sammy stuff before I got to town. But I think I listened to like 9 records or something.
Yeah.
So I would say the quick answers are Van Halen by far.
Right.
And I got really into the Talking Heads again.
Oh, absolutely.
Talking Heads were like one of those bands that my mom always had playing when I was a kid. And so like I've always known their music, and, you know, I've played a ton of like wedding and like cover gigs and a bunch of their songs, but I never really went like super deep into like listening to every record. And I got really into, speaking of podcasts, as we're doing one, I got really into this, you know, Scott Aukerman, he does the Comedy Bang Bang podcast.
Yeah.
So he does like a bunch of music ones, and he does a Talking Head podcast with Adam Scott, who was on like Parks and Recreation.
Mm-hmm.
They do a podcast about the Talking Heads called Talking Heads to My Talking Head.
Right.
And the joke is that they're, you know, they're doing these Zoom podcasts, and they just basically went in order of listening to all the Talking Heads records.
Nice.
And so I would listen to the podcast. They're about 2 hours long, and they're just these, and they're doing a lot of improv comedy and they're kind of bizarre. And then they listen to the record. And so I kind of was like listening to the podcast and I'd listen to the whole record. They had that concert film, Stop Making Sense.
Of course. Yeah.
And so I started watching that like once a week. And so those, yeah, Talking Heads and Van Halen have been like the biggest things. And I feel like kind of musically as a drummer, the combinations of those two bands kind of also are a good like version of how I think of myself.
Yeah,
kind
yeah.
of like slightly caveman drummer, but also really into like four on the floor drums. But
sure.
It's also surprising how much Alex Van Halen plays four on the floor drums. You
totally.
Know, it's almost like it's great. It's so great. So
nice.
Yeah, that's my quick answer.
Awesome. Yeah, I love, in particular, the one for me is in regards to Talking Heads. I mean, no matter how many times I hear Remain in Light, which came out in 1980, I believe. I mean, you want to talk about a prototype for incorporating sort of what we're talking about with what would become sort of some of the electronic music and sort of world beat stuff, Afro beat, whatever you want to call it. Like the amalgamation of all those styles happening in 1980 on Remain in Light is just fucking killer.
Yeah, man. I'm so glad you brought that record up because there was I did a tour with my old band The Exit in probably 2005 or so. Mm-hmm. And this was in the early era of, you know, we had a tape deck in the van, and then we had one of those weird, like, back when there were CD players, do you remember, like, there'd be like a CD player and then you'd have this weird, like, it was an aux cord that would go through like this fake cassette.
Of course. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm only saying it like that because there's probably kids listening to this that like never experienced that.
Right. Yeah. I'll be 45 this year. So I've been through many phases of stereos at this point.
You have a few years on me, but I'm not far behind, but I just like our CD adapter broke like the second day of tour.
Uh-huh.
And I remember we were at like, you know, a Super J or some like truck stop. And we just bought a bunch of the like cheap tapes
because
the tape machine still worked.
Right.
And we got Remain in Light.
Awesome.
And I think at this point, you know, I'd probably heard, you know, what's the
Once in a Lifetime I'd
heard the hit off that.
Right.
But I just remember we put the tape in and we literally left it in at least 2 weeks, if not 3 weeks. And it was just whenever we were driving, that's what was playing.
Yeah.
And we weren't even necessarily listening to it all the time, but it was just kind of, I don't know. I think we were at that. We had been touring so much. I think we were at that point where you're just like sick of everyone's already played all the stuff they love and all the stuff that everyone hates.
Right.
And it was just kind of like, I don't know. Maybe we were on like our headphones. It was just, I just remember that tape was in there for 2 weeks and I liked it. It was cool. It was like, I didn't really think much about it, but I liked it.
Uh-huh.
And there was one night we were on tour and we were stay on somebody's ranch. We're like out in the middle of nowhere and we had smoked a lot of pot.
Yeah.
And I remember for some reason I had my iPod and before this tour, I had had the thought, I'm going to get more into the Talking Heads. So I had my old iPod, the big stupid wheel on it, you know, and I had Remain in Light. And I remember thinking, oh, I have this record on here that I've been listening to every day for 2 weeks, but now I'm high. I have my headphones in. Mind you, I've only ever heard the whole record in our shitty van.
Right.
For 2 weeks straight. So I kind of know these songs, but, you know, and I remember I put in the headphones. I'm really high. And I put on the record and all of a sudden I'm hearing all these things I haven't really ever heard in the songs.
Yeah.
I'm also high.
Right.
And it was like this amazing experience, like these songs that have been kind of just like earworming themselves into my brain.
Right.
And I knew them really well, even though I didn't think I knew them that well. And then I was hearing like, you know, all the stuff you hear in headphones, like all the stuff that Brian Eno is really adding to the songs.
Totally.
And that record like really like changed my life. And
that's amazing.
So it's been great to like get into their other stuff. That will always be my favorite record of theirs. But, and if you're listening to this and you haven't gone into that band, like that's a great record to start with because it's challenging. It's not.
Yeah.
It's but it's such a cool concept where every song is literally one chord change, and they just kind of. They just add layers and they just change vocal parts. But I know a bunch of the drums are looped, but like there's also live. It's it's fascinating. I really would love to like be a fly on the wall to see how they did that record in 1980 of all times.
Yeah.
So great, man.
Fucking A, man. Wow. Well, before I go, I know you had mentioned the exit touring with Muse, and I'm jealous that you got to see that band. I've seen them only once live, and I dig so many of the records. And the one time that I did see him, I was so amazed by the Matt Bellamy's vocals and just how killer that guy is and how he represents himself vocally live. It's like he's every bit as good live as he is, if not better, than he is on the recordings, which is super rare. You know?
Yeah, it's crazy.
God, that's killer that you got to tour with them. That's super cool.
So my band, The Exit, we had like kind of like a brother band, the RX Bandits. Mm-hmm. Do you know them at all?
Mm-mm.
And they're from California. We're from New York, but we would tour together a lot, and we did like a European UK tour in 2003, and we shared a bus. It was the first time I was ever on a bus, and it was really exciting. And you know, pretty much it was rather debaucherous, you know, like two like mid young 20-year-old bands, like a bus, like you can drink all day, like hash, you know, like nothing too debaucherous, but like we were pretty stoned or drunk most of the time, to be honest.
Right.
And I remember there was one night, you know, there was a lot of those moments where everyone's playing each other's stuff that they love or they think is cool. And I remember their guitarist put on Newborn by Muse, the first song on Origin of Symmetry.
Oh, that song rules.
Yeah, and I never heard it. And I remember thinking like, whoa, this is kind of like Jeff Buckley meets Radiohead meets Queen. You know, it was just Rage Against the Machine guitar riff. And
right.
We were like, this is cool. And cut to a year later, my band gets a cool record deal and they get us a real booking agent. And our booking agent books Muse.
Wow.
And so we get the call, hey, have you heard? Because this is 2004. So Muse hadn't really hit in the States yet.
Right.
So they were pretty big in the rest of the world. But like, we get the call, do you want to do this tour? They're going to pay you like $500 a show. It's shitty money, but like, it's a cool tour. And we're like, but we knew the band. So we were kind of excited because we felt like we knew this band, but like most Americans didn't. So we're like, oh, this is cool. I mean, to give you perspective, like I saw one of the last shows I saw at Madison Square Garden end of 2019 was Muse.
Wow.
And we played with Muse at Bowery Ballroom.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Holy shit.
So we did like a tour where like we played like a 200 capacity place in St. Louis, and it's on like this DVD they put out, and it's like, it's mental. Like they're like arguably top five biggest bands in the world. And we were kind of part of, like, it wasn't the first time they came to America, but I mean, just the scale, if you know Bowery Ballroom, I think it's an 800, maybe 500 capacity room in New York. And they were great. They were like really, I think they really got a kick out of us because we were like, we were a trio. It was a trio. We had one other guy on tour with us. We didn't have any roadies. We were kind of fuck ups. And we ended up on this tour with them. And they, you know, they had a bus. They weren't like super luxurious, but I think they got, I mean, I remember we were like on tour. We're in Florida. We play Orlando. And the next show on tour was L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like we had 2 days to get to LA. And so, you know, I literally remember like loading out of the show, driving for 2 days straight and loading in to our next show and like catching up with them. We're like, hey, what do you guys do? And they're like, oh yeah, well, they flew us.
Of course.
Like we flew to Tahoe and went skiing and then not like in a braggy way, just like in a, we are a successful band and we do not have to drive for 3 days straight.
Right.
but I think they got a kick out of us, and they had always like, we did like two or three tours with them.
Wow.
Back when they could have had like pretty much anybody touring with us, because honestly, like we just got on, we got along.
Amazing.
And so that's kind of like some of the funny part about being friends with Jeremy. Cause now Jeremy texts for Muse.
Wow.
And it's kind of this full circle because I've seen Dom play with a bunch of different companies, and now he plays Q and his drums sound amazing. And so, those guys I'm still pretty, you know, pretty friendly with Dom, their drummer. Like Matt, I haven't, you know, we said hi at Madison Square Garden a couple of years ago. But yeah. I mean, yeah, to answer your question, like they're probably the best live band I've ever seen in terms of just like
so good.
sounding like a record, but not in a bad way. It's
yeah.
Just, you know, I think a lot of people don't give them enough credit.
Right.
Because, you know, they're trying to keep up with in radio singles and stuff, but like those guys can play. Like Matt can shred.
Yes.
I think Dom is a hugely underrated drummer. Uh-huh. I mean, he was playing the tracks, you know, in 1999.
Right.
Where like and when I say that, I mean like he's been playing live with a metronome for so long. He doesn't sound like it, but he has that like he sounds like a quantized drummer when he plays live.
Uh-huh.
You know, and yeah. And I say that in like. In a good way, like it's impressive.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Like it's he self mixes himself when he plays, and
yeah,
nice totally. Guy. And so yeah, it's it was a crazy time, and it's I always get a kick out of seeing anything they're doing because I feel you know I have a nostalgic part of me feeling like, oh way back when
right.
nobody well people knew about them, but like. It's amazing to see how big they've become.
Amazing, man. Right on, Gunnar. Well, it was fun talking to you, man, and walking through
you
the years,
man.
Hearing about all of your band's projects and otherwise throughout the years. And again, congrats on the Pucifer thing, depending on how you want to
yeah.
pronounce it. I look forward to checking that out on April 17th, I believe it is. So that'll
yeah, April 17th, PucifierLive.com. We'll be doing a whole record, and I saw a little trailer of it yesterday, and I kind of blew my mind because I was telling my dad today, I was like, I was there. I remember doing this.
Right.
And then they put up the trailer today, and I was like, holy shit, like this looks amazing.
Right.
I mean, it looks like we're in a comic book or something. Like it's
super cool.
Wrestlers and like all these hijinks, and it's like,
oh, yeah.
it's like Monty Python meets like fucking Luchador Libre. I don't know. It's crazy.
Awesome.
Yeah, man.
Very cool. Right on, man. Well, it was good talking to you. Best of luck going forward.
You
and
too,
we'll have to catch up soon.
Thanks a lot, man.
All right, Gunnar. All right, everybody, thanks for hanging. Thanks to Gunnar for rapping. It's a trip that he lives in Greenpoint, and I lived there for many years before moving recently. Super cool talking to him about the Pucifer gig, as well as working with the boss and all that other good stuff. Talking heads, remain in light. That's what I'm talking about. We'll catch y'all in the next one. Crash, bang, boom.